Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Carrie Adloyd. How do we grieve for someone? How does it change and evolve as we get older? My dad died when I was 15, and it took me many, many years to be able to express what I had gone through. So I decided to create Griefcast, a chance to talk, share, and laugh about the weirdness of grief and death. But with comedians, so it's not that depressing, I promise. Each time I talk to a different comedian about their own personal experience of grief as we remember someone that they have lost along the way. Whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club, this is a chance to talk about the peculiar human process of death. Welcome to Griefcast.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, Griefsters. Hope you're okay and at least the football has been cheering you on this week if you are supporting England or Sweden today. Just to remind you, we have a live event coming up on the 15th of September as part of the London Podcast Festival. I'll be talking grief, funeral music and wake canapes with Andrew Hunter-Murray from the hilarious No Such Thing as a Fish podcast, and also by Erin Gibson, who hosts the incredible Throwing Shade podcast all the way from the Americas. If you head to the King's Place website, you can find all the details of the festival and book tickets as well. This week I'm joined by actor and writer Rebecca Paynton. Rebecca has been seen in EastEnders, Casualty, and she wrote and performed her one-woman show, Sometimes I Laugh Like My Sister, which she's performed all over the world. Rebecca came in to talk to me about her dad, who died in a cycling accident when she was 6 years old, and her sister Kate, who was killed whilst working as a journalist in Somalia in 2005. This conversation was recorded before the horrific shootings at the Capital Gazette in Maryland and is dedicated to the journalists who were killed in that incident: Gerald Fishman, Rob Hyson, John McNamara, Rebecca Smith and Wendy Winters. And as Rebecca says in her talk, sadly journalists are under threat all over the world every single day, so I'd also like to dedicate it to Ibrahim Al-Munja in Syria, Shujat Bakari in India, Paul Rivas Bravo in Colombia, Mohammed Al-Qadazi in Yemen, and Nawras Ali Rajabi in Afghanistan, who also died simply doing their job this year. Welcome to Griefcast. I'm here today with actor and writer Rebecca Payton.
Hello there.
Hello. We were just talking before we started recording. I have had so many people say to me, you should get Rebecca Payton on. And you have equally had people say, you should listen to Griefcast. So, because we've both been, what is it, the grief industry? What do we think?
I think that's what it is, man. Yeah. I think it's the I was having, working this weekend with a friend and somebody, we were talking about loss and grief, and our colleague just went, yeah, you're the grief police.
The grief police.
And I quite like grief police. So I think I'm like, hey, we should do something. We should do a show. The grief police.
That's really nice.
Because there is a lot about policing grief in life.
Yeah.
Including from people like me who are like, you ain't had no murder, you ain't had no grief. Get not it. I mean, that's not how I do think. But I think people sometimes feel they're like, oh, I'm really sad about something. I'm like, that's okay. You've had something awful happen to you. It doesn't have to be as glamorous as my losses, darling. You can have your losses and they're awful as well. You know, there isn't a hierarchy. But then there are people who want to police how you grieve.
Yeah.
And I'm like, the grief police is something. You can't have that idea. Ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
That was my idea. Well, it was actually Mark's idea, but hey, Mark.
Coming to Edinburgh next year, Rebecca's show, Grief Police. So we've already paid for the brochure, so you can't do anything with it.
It's done. Exactly. You can't have it.
Yeah.
It's all done.
Rebecca, you are part of the grief police, as I am. who are we remembering today?
Well, for me, there have been a lot of losses. That a lot of people have experienced by my, you know, I'm middle-aged, by my stage of life. So, you know, grandparents, great uncles and aunts, pets, friends. But 40 years ago, my father was killed when I was 6. And then 13 years ago, my sister was murdered. So it's the both of them, and they vie for attention.
Yeah. That is huge. I mean, there's no hierarchy, but that's big.
I suppose one of the things I'm really aware of is that these losses are cultural as well.
Yeah.
We're very lucky to live in a society where a lot of us will, at the moment we'll die in the gentle arms of the NHS. I hope to. I'm not sure that anybody else's children will because of what's happening to it, but that's how a lot of death is encountered and people have long-term illnesses and things like that. We live in a very weird country at a very specific time in history. Mm. That is not the experience of most people in the world. And there are a lot of conflict zones where, you know, I spent a lot of time in South Africa, I have family there and I've taken a show that I do there. And everybody really, and I'm not joking, everybody knows somebody really who has been touched by murder, for example, or by road traffic accidents, which are both extremely violent. Because there is a big problem. And I'm not, you know, South Africa's a wonderful place. But there are lots of countries like that and we just don't think about it. Obviously, we don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about it. I like lying on the sofa watching telly, you know.
Yeah. But it's funny, isn't it, the perception of other countries, because I have a friend who lives in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes I read stuff and I'm like, are you okay? What's happening? And she's like, you live in London? She was like, we hear about that in Mexico. Like, people worry about London in Mexico. And I was like, oh, yeah. Because you always think your world is this perfect bubble. Well, it's fine here. But,
totally.
Mexico's dangerous.
Literally, if it's not touching you on your street, in your home, then essentially your day is okay.
Yeah.
I mean, actually. And you can't, I don't think you can. I mean, I do, and I don't think it's done me any good. But I don't think you can live in a place where you're constantly fearing whatever it is, and it engenders enormous anxiety. And as we all know, it's not going to stop it happening.
No,
worrying about it won't stop it.
So, should we? Where to begin? Where to begin, Rebecca? Because I know. So, you did a show about your sister.
Yes.
Which is called Sometimes I Laugh Like My Sister.
That's right. Yeah.
A sort of one woman show, which I have seen. So I'm getting my head. We know that story. I know that story.
Yeah.
So let's start with your dad, maybe.
Yeah.
What happened with your dad?
Because I didn't know that, actually, till you just said that, I think. Yeah. I'd sort of, because of the show was so much about your sister, I'd sort of removed that part from my brain. Yeah. So, yeah, what happened?
He went out for a bike ride on a beautiful summer's evening.
Oh, God.
31st of May, 40 years ago. And in our village, small village in the middle of nowhere in Suffolk, he was essentially crushed between two vehicles. And he lived for a few weeks in hospital as they tried to save his life. But he died of his injuries. The worst thing, for the thing that I, you know, hey, this is a fun comedy podcast. ladies and gentlemen, the thing that turns over in my mind is the knowledge that he actually, quite rarely for cycling accident, he didn't have any brain damage.
Wow.
It was all trauma wounds to his internal organs. So he was himself. They put him into a coma, obviously to try and give his body a chance to save itself, but he died.
And how old were you when that happened?
I was 6.
Oh.
It's a very bad age.
I mean, it's
there isn't a good age. There isn't a good age.
No, there isn't a good age. But whatever age someone says, it feels bad.
Feels awful.
Yeah.
I think what happens, and I watch people do it, we either think of ourselves at 6, we think of our children at 6, we think of somebody we know at 6, or whatever age it is. I mean, because one of the experiences I think of other people's trauma, which I'm sort of obsessed with and fascinated by, is that mostly what a lot of us will do is we go into ourselves and go, wow. And the way I can, talk to you about your losses is go, what is that like?
Yeah.
Or the fact that you're busy or had a difficulty. I'm like, oh, how would that be for me?
Yeah.
Which isn't a selfish act. It's an act of empathy. That's kind of what I have to do in order to go, oh, that sounds difficult.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly how empathy works. But I think it's funny because, like, when I say I was 15 and my dad died, people are like, oh, you're so young. And I think, I suppose I wasn't that. But, like, you know, yeah, exactly. I was young, but 6 is young. It's all young. Like, there's no good age.
Man, 59 is young. My mum's parents died when she was 59. And that was rubbish as well.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly. Yeah. So how was that dealt with, that grief particularly? Like, was it discussed a lot? Were your family very open about it? Did you sort of share the emotions or was it tidied away? You know, how did your family cope with
it? Well, so there was my mother and her 3 children then. And my mother is preternaturally competent. She's kind of, I love her enormously, but she's also massively irritating, I've come to realise, as an example of a human being.
Right, okay, because an unusual. Yeah,
she's astonishingly well adjusted.
Wow.
Which is all very well, Carriere.
But not all of us got that gene.
When you end up coming out of a totally other sausage machine that's shaped like chaos. She talked about Dad. She made a decision, and she could make this decision because luckily somebody killed my father, and the guy who killed my father, who was responsible for his death, his car was insured. He had insurance, so it meant that there was some insurance payout.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the things one of my bet noir is, it's a lottery. We were lucky to be killed by somebody who had insurance. He was lucky to be killed by, but Dad wasn't lucky. Dad was not lucky. I'm not saying that, but given that he died, we were lucky that we had that. And Mum made a decision that she wanted us to retain whatever we could of our childhood, this having happened to us. So we were 10, Charlie was 10, my older brother, my sister Kate was 12, I was 6. And that's what she wanted for us. And she was very focused on that. And she was a bit, I think she was, you know, I think she would say, she was very protective of that. I think sometimes people used to say to her, you do too much, Angela, you should be making them do the washing up and paint the outside of the house and quickly nip down a coal mine so that you can put your feet up. And her attitude was, no, they're kids.
Yeah.
They've already had their childhood taken away. It's been trashed. What can I do to maintain something for them?
Which, I totally understand. Because, it's funny, isn't it? Like when, again, like we said, grief police, other people's opinions of how children should be dealt with.
And
it's like, man, you're dealing with, like, your dad was killed.
Like, you know.
Holidays forever for those children is how
I
feel.
Do you know what I mean?
Sweets
totally.
For dinner and holidays forever.
Totally.
No homework.
But boy, do people have opinions on it. It's absolutely fascinating. And then a household, it was the 1980s, it was Suffolk. So, I don't know.
Already it sounds.
Suffolk. It was, I adore Suffolk. And I go back a lot. But people did have opinions. People literally who would never have given my mother their opinion when she had a proper owner.
Yeah.
Once her owner was gone, they could step in and tell her how things should be done.
Yeah.
And my mother, luckily, I don't know what she's made of. It's titanium, but it's slightly more flexible. It's chewing gum and titanium. I presume that's something. But she...
Titanium.
Yeah, chewtanium.
Titanium.
Isn't that a character from Star Wars? But she... So she fielded all that stuff.
Wow. Did you feel not very aware of that? Did you feel like your mum kind of protected you from anyone being annoying or?
Well, you can't. What's fascinating. Yeah. I kind of have this thing I talk about endlessly if I can grab hold of someone and keep them still long enough, which is about the gaslighting of children. It's cultural and this is also in a specific place. People, there's a thing that I would like to chuck out the window for good of children being resilient.
Mm.
They aren't any more resilient than you are. In fact, they're probably less resilient than you.
Yeah.
Because they aren't formed yet. But what they do is they will sit and cry on your lap and go, Granny, and where's Granny, and where's Granny? And you're like, well, Granny's, you know, this, whatever your explanation of death is. There is no explanation, but whatever that is. And then they go and play on the floor. Yeah. They stop crying. And people go, oh, look, she's fine. No, that's the equivalent of you going to the pub.
Yeah.
You know, that's the equivalent of you watching 5 episodes of Mad Men.
Yeah, without a break and not going to the loo.
Exactly. But what we observe, because what we want, because we refuse in general to look at a child's pain. We don't want to see it. It's one thing when a child is screaming because they don't want to wear their Wellington boots. Okay.
Yeah.
And then you can go, oh, Malcolm, he's impossible. He needs to wear his Wellington boots. And it is slightly absurd. Not that it's good to let the child know it's absurd unless it's necessary, but you know. But what we can't bear is looking in the eyes of a child who simply knows more than we do. We find it extremely difficult because it's wrong. It's wrong.
Yeah.
And they can't articulate stuff necessarily. Adults can't articulate stuff either, good Lord. But children often struggle to articulate stuff. And it is inarticulable. Is that a word? I love the fact that probably isn't a word.
That's really interesting because I think that's a really interesting point, this idea that, like, well, they'll be fine. They'll be okay.
Yeah, they're fine. Look at this. She's smiling. Oh, she's doing
so
fine
great
at school.
They adapt.
All of that. A friend of mine, a wonderful friend of mine, a school friend who's now lives in Canada, we met up one summer. And she'd had, unfortunately, two of her friends had died of breast cancer and there were some small children in these families. And she was describing this to me. And she said, well, this one's fine because they're doing this, that and the other. They're going to school. And the other one is really acting up and being really difficult. And we're really worried about them. And I said, I don't know. I ain't no professional, but I think you might have it the wrong way around.
Yeah.
Because the good child who is struggling to make everyone else well around them
is in so much agony.
Yeah, and isn't expressing and isn't doing what I did after my sister died, which is a year I drank every day after Kate died, every day, not in the mornings.
I have my standards.
You know, exactly. People had an opinion about that. People had opinions. They told me, and I'm like, wow, that's fascinating that you've got an opinion on that. Tell me again what it was like when your sister died, because I'm going to really find this interesting.
It's
so extraordinary, and they do, and so I said to my friend, I said, listen, I think the kid who's behaving themselves might be worth trying to talk to them. It might be worth finding something. And what they don't want to do is upset this precious vessel that's doing really well.
They're holding it together like
a glass
capsule.
And they're going to come apart. They might not, but they may well come apart later in life.
Well, I always think it's funny, isn't it? Because and I don't mean this negatively at all, it's just life. What they're seeing is a child getting on with it, and there's a relief in that. Oh, thank God, because they're suffering, they're in pain, they don't know how to help.
Totally.
Oh, she's just getting on with it. Great.
I haven't got to manage this or sort it out.
But this one who's screaming and shouting, and also the screaming and shouting child is still in pain as well, they're expressing
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
But I would say I was definitely that child who's like, I'm fine.
Well, you
were so, I was fine.
Tobogganable, that's what I call it.
What?
Totally tobogganable.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Like, you would have looked and gone, yeah, she's fine.
Yeah.
Look at that, she's doing fine.
And was it your intention to comfort the people around you?
I think it must have been deep down, just like, don't cause a fuss, because it feels like there's enough fuss already. Like, it was a very sort of, I'm quite practical. And I think I just thought, like, I saw the option. I was 15. I could have gone and get, you know, my friends were going and get very wasted and taking a lot of drugs. And they didn't have dead parents. They're being teenagers. I saw that option. I thought, no, that would stress everybody out. Like, don't do that. And I also was scared. There was a mix of, like, also, I don't want to die. I'm now terrified of dying.
So did their death then become something that was very far more concrete than it had been previously?
Yeah, definitely. It was like, well, don't do it because you're going to die. Everyone's going to die any minute.
So, and you're going to bring it on.
I'll bring it on. So
by having a weird perno.
Yeah. Like, don't take any drugs. Especially, I grew up in that era where, like, drugs were...
Oh, yeah.
We were completely told all the time, you take one ecstasy, you'll die. So when my friends would die, I'd be like, you're going to die. But they all were fine. Luckily, obviously, some people aren't. But, yeah, it was... I definitely was that child. And it's interesting. What were you then? Do you remember? Were you six, too young? Were you kind of someone who was like, I'm fine?
I was, I think, I mean, I'd have to put this out here right away, especially for the benefit of my wonderful brother who's still with us and my dead sister who, well, quite frankly, she can go stuff herself. She's not around anymore. I can tell you what, like, I was a very noisy,
right,
show off.
Now, you're an actor, I'm an actor. I know what it means to be a dramatic child, and I know what it means that you already label yourself as a show off. I'm with you.
Yeah, no, I was. And I think I'd come into what was quite a decently functioning family, right, as the fifth wheel.
Yeah.
And I think my parents were pleased. I don't know that it was as pleasing for my siblings.
Right, yeah.
I think maybe as a baby it was fine, but then I grew up into something awful and was always trying to keep up and talking nonsense and quite charming as a little kid. So I think it was, yeah, that situation. Oh, isn't she sweet? And my brother and sister, I think, were like, no,
no,
she isn't.
She's a pain in the ass, guys.
Nothing sweet about this thing. And I think it belied, I know it belied, a very sort of jittery, terrified human being.
Mm.
One of the reasons I'm a performer is I can conceal virtually anything. I say that, obviously someone's going to say to me, you ain't concealed it from me, I saw it all along. But I can conceal a great deal, and it's why I'm an actor. And
yeah,
I would say,
same, really, yeah, good at hiding.
Yeah, I can hide all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And I can simulate something. I can simulate whatever's necessary.
Yes.
I would describe myself as manipulative, but I don't use it for evil things.
Yes.
That's my thing. And I've decided to own the fact that I think I'm manipulative because it's born of this time. So when Dad died, I remember being massively concerned then, but of course, about my mother, because,
yeah,
I knew what our fate was if Mum died.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
and
what
I
had, like,
yeah,
one down. We got one
and
left
you're very
now.
Close.
Yeah.
And then you know how easily it can happen.
Yes, yes. And that's what made me so, like, jittery and anxious. Yeah. I was like, well, they can go, these people,
yeah,
are not reliable.
Anything can happen. They're
completely
unreliable.
I thought they were reliable. No, 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 no,
when
no.
When they said to you they'd always be there,
no, well,
it was a lie.
They fucking lied.
Exactly.
So now you need to get your shit together because these guys can go at,
yeah,
any time.
Yeah,
okay.
And you've got to be,
yeah,
ready for it. So,
yeah,
as small as I was well aware that it was a decade,
yeah,
of at least, of being looked after. Something happened to Mum, of being looked after by whoever. Now, it happened to, I knew that we were going to go. Mum was very clear and very open.
Wow.
I knew we would go to this particular uncle and aunt of ours, who I love very much, and they're great. And they know I love them, but they will be the first people to understand that I wouldn't have wanted that to happen. You
yeah,
know, I wanted,
yeah,
to be with my mum. So that was terrifying. So I think my major concern in life became making sure my mother was okay.
Mm.
And she and I have talked about this a lot. I'm sort of, I think I became an emotional lightning rod for her. So my mother is a very, ironically, my mother is a very private person.
Yeah.
And she, her friend, people, she knows masses of people. She's very popular. God damn her. And she will, people will say to me, I'll be in my hometown in Bury St. Edmunds, beautiful Bury St. Edmunds. And people say, oh, Rebecca, how's your mum? Because, you know, it can be a bit difficult to tell. And I'm like, yeah, no, it's virtually impossible to tell.
Wow.
My brother and I know, and I would say her sisters know, but she's very, very, and her close friends, she was a very private person. So, and she struggled.
Mm.
And, you know, I remember terrible times of her sort of being essentially the desperation of our situation,
yeah,
and her terrible, unimaginable loss, and my knowledge that she had to keep going.
Yeah, there's no choice.
She's got to go to the shops.
Three kids as well.
You know, like, it's all of that. And for all that we weren't left in situations that some people I know were financially, and
yeah,
I make no bones about that. I didn't grow up in a paper bag in the middle of the road. I mean, we didn't go skiing every year. But
oh,
I
so hard for you.
I know, it was extremely difficult. I was very angry about it for a long time, but I've had some therapy. But so, you know, I make no pretense about how fortunate we were in our circumstances. But I worked on her.
Mm.
And that kind of has never gone away. She's
wow.
now 78 and 46, and I still, especially then, my bloody sister dying. My mother's welfare for me is sort of paramount,
yeah.
really. Partly because I can't bear, she's had this cavalcade of not long before my sister died, my mum's best friend, her sister died. She's, you know, lost all of the people like she would have at her age, all her parents and aunts and uncles. And, you know, there was a baby before the three of us. My mother and father had a stillborn child.
Wow.
My mother has been, so it's funny when people say to me, oh, you've been through a lot, I'm like, oh, I got a story for you, girl. And she's like culturally
yeah.
massively off the scale, so my concern has been for her. And she Well, I mean, she was extraordinary, really. She'd talk about anything. I can ask her any question. And she's remarkable and always has been very honest, searingly honest. We talk and discuss anything and everything. There's nothing off limits.
That's amazing, though, to have that
so valuable
support, especially when
so
you
valuable.
Are, yeah, you know, to be a six-year-old and grow up with yeah. that atmosphere, I think, must
totally.
Be hugely healing in a way, as much
yeah.
as it can be.
No,
it
absolutely.
Go away.
At the same time, I knew by the time I was 12 that I was in massive trouble psychologically, and she wasn't really able to do anything about that because it was 1980s, it was Suffolk. So my appeal to have some kind of therapy, when I asked her to I could have therapy, she was like, I didn't even know we'd heard the word. I presumed you'd heard it on telly. And we know what we're going to do in Suffolk in the 1980s.
Did you ask when you were 12?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you say,
oh, because
God.
I knew I was absolutely as barking as a stack of whatever. And I will use lots of terms like barking and crazy, which I recognise that some people find offensive, but I am certified, quite frankly.
Yeah.
So I will own them. I don't know what other words to use about myself.
It is tricky. I know that I've encountered that recently of people finding those words difficult. And I'm like, the only words I've got, like,
I don't know what else to say.
And I think barking is a real, like, I know what you mean.
Yeah, barking is such a good word. And it isn't, what's fascinating to me about mental health, it's all very well we have these definitions and diagnoses, but it isn't the same as a twisted ankle if you're, say, massively emotionally unstable.
Yeah.
What do I say about that? There isn't a particular thing. So there aren't words, as far as I'm
yeah,
concerned.
There aren't.
And there probably are in the enormous, you know, the enormous book
yes.
of definitions. But I have not got the time.
Wow.
I'm a bit dyslexic. I'm not going to sit and read that book and try and work out what I am. And then you wouldn't know what it word meant if I
yeah.
use it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem.
So what's
is
the point?
The culture thing. So when you were 12, you said you wanted therapy.
Mm.
And were you close to your sister at that point? Because she's 6 years
older
than
older
you.
Me.
She was 6 years older than you. So were you? Did you see your brother and sister dealing with it very differently? Or
I sort of felt partially, to a certain extent, like an only child in my family in a way. They were very close.
Right, and they were sort of, yeah, they seemed like it.
Yeah, they were. Charlie's 4 years older than me. Kate's 2 years older
yeah.
than that. They're incredibly close. My sister adored my brother, and my brother adored my sister. And still does, I'm sure. They were a unit, really.
Aww.
A very self-sufficient, three of us are very different. The two of them so different, but so loving. My sister protected and defended my brother in some extraordinary ways. And Kate just respected everything about him, really. He's an incredible guy. And then there was me. And I am incredible. There was no love lost between us, really, till my sister went to university and I went to stay with her when I was 14. And when I was 14 and she was 20, 21, her friends wanted to know whether I was the younger or the older sister, which when I was 14 and she was 20 was pretty cool.
Yeah.
By the time we were 28 and 22 and people still thought she was the younger sister, we were in Germany on holiday, we said to these people, well, they were like, oh, are you twins? No, we're not twins. Well, we know that we're sisters. Oh, well, there's 6 years between us and she's 28. And somebody went, so you're 34. And I was like, okay, forget this with my stupid Michael Caine looky-likey face. No offence, Michael. This is
that
really
is
annoying.
Worst,
my sister
it?
Was the pretty one. And so I went to university with her and it just flipped. I went to stay with her in Manchester and it flipped a switch. And our relationship, that's when my relationship with my sister really kicked in.
Yeah, and then you know them, you become knowing them as an adult, I guess.
Totally, and we weren't on each
different.
Other's territory.
Yeah, yeah.
And we weren't in the, we were, it was just the two of us.
Yeah.
It wasn't the four of us, which has its own, although, you
yeah,
know, it's all those politics
dynamic,
already established.
Yeah.
And it became the kind of relationship that I think a lot of people simply don't experience. If you don't have a sibling, you don't experience it. I mean, I know lots of people who've got siblings. They've still got their really irritating, awful siblings, and I've gone and lost mine, bastards. And they're like, well, I'd be happy without mine and get rid of them quite merrily.
Yeah.
And it was. It was just this extraordinary, extraordinary, what I would refer to as a love affair. I know in our culture we're obsessed with who's doing sex with whom, but I think love is far broader than that.
Yeah.
And it was just she sustained me. She was the only person I talked to about my box of frogs in my head. I didn't really talk to anybody about it. And she was very lacking in belief in herself, extraordinarily, because she went on to achieve extraordinary things, but she was very competitive. But I could say to her, yes, you can, and I think you can, and this is how you can. So we had this very symbiotic relationship. So that when she went, it's taken me years to realise how much of myself was actually Kate. And when she went, she took me with her. And I don't have qualities I used to have. And nobody can replace it. Frustratingly, and my God, I've looked. But it can't be replaced. And I think the same thing happened to me with Dad when Dad died. Dad liked me being a show off. Dad loved all of that. And my mother and my brother and my... I remember one year I was with a lovely guy at the time. He came for Easter. It was me and my mum, my brother and my sister at Easter. I went to the sitting room, I put on some music and I was dancing around, just dancing around, 11 o'clock in the morning, Easter Sunday. And they all came in one by one, all four of them, and looked at me. And I stopped. And I guess I was 20-something, 26, 27. And I suddenly realised for the first time, I'm not a cuckoo. I'm my father's daughter.
Ugh.
And it took me all that time to realise I wasn't just an aberration, like some hideous aberration in this other family.
Yeah.
Not that they didn't love me, not that we didn't get on, we had great times. I was so weird, and I am weird compared to them.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I'm like Dad.
It's funny, isn't it? Yeah, I'm very similar to my dad way. Yeah, that definitely. I mean, my whole life has been called a show off, and it took me years to realise that. And that was a huge part of my creative journey, to realise that it was okay to want to be an actor. And I thought it was the worst thing to do.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
you should have joined
like the
militia somewhere where you could be like, a gun for hire and kill people would be better.
Like, yeah, like you want attention. How awful! And then realising, quite similar. Like, my dad was a bit of a show off. And similarly, when I met my great aunts, who my grandpa's sisters, that's my dad's sisters, and I think I'd had so many men in my life who were like that, but no women. So there's big bombastic men, but I didn't know any women. I thought it was sort of shameful to be a woman and be this loud. And I met this great aunt, and she started telling me this the quiet great aunt Anne, who was lovely, and she was telling me about great aunt Kitty, who was the first woman in Bridgend to wear trousers, and you know, great aunt, you know, and then Phyllis, who went to New Zealand, and Mimi, who was an atheist amongst all these critics. And I was like, oh, there they are.
It all makes sense now.
Like the power of family.
I mean, it's enormous.
Enormous. And I remember she just described Kitty, and I was like, oh, that sounds like me. Like the bolshiness and the opinionatedness. And I'd always thought, again, you feel like an aberration.
Yeah, you feel like, something from...
This is wrong. What I do is wrong because I can't see anyone else doing it.
Totally.
Yeah, it's really powerful, isn't it?
And you might hit upon a mentor, as they call them, or just a family friend or something who goes,
that's
great, stick at it. You're allowed to be whatever it is. But often people don't. And so I think a lot of young people and, you know, teenagers and kids really struggle because whatever it is that drives them seems so wrong.
And especially, like you said, your dad not being there.
Totally.
Not having that other character to join in.
Absolutely, all of that.
Yeah.
And he was, and also, my father was an orphan.
Right.
So there's no family. Yeah. My brother is the only person who's related to my dad. And my brother and I are really different.
We
do share things in common. But Charlie is not a show-off.
And there's nothing wrong with not being a show-off.
No, it's brilliant. I admire it. I wish I could be like him. I look at these people and think, why can't I be like these people? My mother, who doesn't, she's a Christian. She works so hard. She does much for charity. She will not read in church.
Wow. As you said that, I was like, I'll read in church.
I'd like, love it. My own wedding. There's a Freudian slip. At my own sister's funeral. There you go. This is terribly Freudian now that I'm freestyling. I did at her memorial in Johannesburg, and then at her funeral in Bury St. Albans, I spoke.
Yeah.
And people are like, how did you do that? I'm like, it's the easiest thing in the world to get up and not cry and to make jokes.
Yeah, that's
in
my
those
skill.
Circumstances. That is the best moment.
Ask me
Everything
to be quiet.
Everything else is hell. Yeah. No, exactly.
I can't do that.
But it's still, I think I still experience shame. I'm sitting here talking to you about it, and it hasn't gone away. Although I have, because I think, it's okay if I put it on stage.
Yes, that's acceptable place,
you know,
for
exactly.
It.
And I did, you
outside
know, I did
some, of that.
Yeah, it's not okay. Yeah. It's okay if I, you know, you're getting married and you want me to read at your wedding. Brilliant.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's great.
Then everyone loves you. Oh, we'll ask Rebecca to do it. Great.
Yeah, you read so well. And then I have to say to people, I'm an actor. I feel real. I feel a cheat. This is like what I do.
Get up in a pub and just start doing a reading. You're an arsehole.
Exactly.
Yeah,
or on the tube. Yeah. I just think people really object.
And it's hard because it wasn't just my, you know, I remember my mum, she listens. Sorry, mum, but she would always be like, I felt that from my mum and her side of the family of like, wanting too much, showing off was kind of like, oh, you're showing off, you want attention.
Yeah.
But it's also school, like teachers, everything.
Wasn't okay
the
there.
Whole world was like, what are you doing? Stop asking for attention. So you're like, yeah, you're right, sorry, what an awful thing to do. So you mentioned your sister's funeral.
Yes.
What happened to your sister? How did your sister die?
So Kate, very jealous of my father, wanted to have a totally other and more flamboyant death. And she achieved it. She was a very competitive individual. She was the senior producer, Africa producer for the BBC, which meant she was based in Johannesburg. She'd been there a long time. And She was asked at very short notice to go to Somalia because somebody had dropped out of a trip to Somalia at the time. Arguably, Somalia was the single most dangerous place in the world. It's particularly dangerous for anybody who wasn't Somali, wasn't local.
So when was this? What sort of year?
This is 2005.
Right, okay, yeah.
February 2005. And to cut an agonisingly and horrendously, devastatingly long story short, she arrived in Mogadishu, and hours after they'd arrived, she was round on the street side of their parked car and was shot once in the back by a passing gunman. She was taken to a hospital where they attempted to save her life. There's no blood bank in Somalia. It's one of the things I come back to all the time. I'm like, people, I think, don't even realise we have a blood service. We have public hospitals. We are so lucky. Luckily, she was in a place with extraordinary trauma surgeons. Like so many places in the world, the trauma surgeons in Mogadishu are splendid and astonishing because that's what they're dealing with a lot of the time. But there is no blood bank, and Kate was a very rare blood group. And although many, many Somali people turned up to give blood when they heard, they only got a couple of pints and she died of blood loss. Post-operatively, they took out her spleen and she died post-operatively. She never came around.
Oh, God.
Even telling the story, I tell it to people sometimes and I had to tell it in a really serious kind of way and like engage their eye contact. And essentially do what I did as a kid, which was help people through the story of my father having died. I have to help people through the story of my sister's death. And it's off the wall. People will sometimes go, oh God, I saw this on the news. I'm like, oh God, I remember it. Some people who are sort of conversant with either African politics or current affairs or whatever. Or it's stuck in their mind because she was white and Western and female. An important death, ladies and gentlemen. not one of those ordinary deaths of who cares. You know, they had very, very strong sense of this foreigner, this Westerner, this Western blonde. I always say this blonde Western woman was killed, so it was big news. It was front page news.
And also the fact that she was a journalist, was that sort of unusual? Like, because you said Somalia was very dangerous at that time, but like for a journalist to be killed, was that...
Well, I'd love to say it was unusual. It isn't. More journalists die than we're aware of, because of course if somebody like this died, or when, you know, Frank Gardner wonderfully survived the horrendous attack on him, it's all over the news because we are interested in some these people who were already known to us in a way. But the journalists who are most at risk, and I would also include media workers, because if you're a stringer or a taxi driver or a translator, you can be an incredible risk in country, in your own country, because it can be seen as taking sides. It's obviously in different places, it's a very complicated matter. So far more people who are from the country they are killed in are killed. The reason someone like Kate or Frank are big news is because they are from another place. In a foreign land. But Mexican journalists die a lot. I mean, it's the list. There's lists are maintained, and it's horrifying, really.
Yeah, you read out at your show, didn't you?
A list. There's five. Yeah. I read at the end of the show every time I do the show. I've done the show 111 times now, and at the end of every show, Martin, who's my collaborator, although he's mostly there in spirit now because he's never in the UK, but we read out a list. I read out a list of five journalists who've been killed, and I'll never get through them all. I'll never get through them all unless somebody would like to book the show, and I'd love to come and do the show, and it's a really great show. It's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous, and it's all over the world. It's rarely, say, Western Europe, and it's not North America by and large.
I suppose that's what I meant by rare, like that it's, like a BBC journalist. Like, that would seem to me, who doesn't know about these things, it would be a shocking story. But you're right, the cameramen and the people who are not...
Everybody else. Yeah, everybody is not envisioned, essentially. Yeah. And what happens is, as well, say BBC, CNN, Fox News, the large organisations, if they go to places... Well, number one, they run risk assessments.
Yeah.
My sister's risk assessment stated... She didn't do it because she was sort of just... She went to Somalia because she thought she was going to lose her job.
Right.
She was told not long before, that just literally hours before, in a meeting with her manager, that... Her contract renewal was in question because her commitment to the job was in doubt. She was adopting a child. She'd met a guy and she was in the process of adopting his child. So I think there is no doubt that her eye was slightly off the ball at the time. And so she felt she had to go to Somalia in order not to lose her job. And she didn't want to go. And her risk assessment says, it's written by an ex-SAS guy, her risk assessment. And it says it was approaching, it's the edges of acceptable risk.
Wow.
Which for an SAS person is basically like you or me running around waving our pants in the air. I mean, it's like screaming and yelling, saying, this isn't okay, actually. So when she was killed, the BBC, They were remarkably brilliant and supportive when she died and did all the practical stuff and were incredible. And then directly they realised that we had questions about what had gone on. They shut down and then they started coming for us. It was extremely unpleasant. I'm a massive fan of the BBC. I'll be on the streets to protect and defend the licence fee. But I will never forgive the individuals who bore down on us.
So what did they do?
They essentially wouldn't answer our questions. They wouldn't answer the coroner's questions. The coroners had to get quite aggressive with them.
Wow.
It was amazing. It was like being in a Kafka-esque situation because you're like, but you're the BBC and you're busily holding people to account in radio studios and television studios up and down the land. And now you're just putting your T-shirt over your face and going, nah, 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 when we ask you a question.
And
it was
that
amazing.
Was just to get more information about why Kate had gone and what had happened. Because, I mean, having seen the show, I know you say in the show that you spoke to a journalist who had dealt with Somalia for the past 20 years who said he wouldn't have gone at that time.
Oh, totally. I mean, Somali specialists, just they wouldn't have gone. The morning after the trip, somebody extremely famous was in my city room and he just went, cheap trip. It was a cheap trip. It was two people. You shouldn't send two people who'd never been to Somalia before to somewhere like that. It was an oversight because the management was in a state of chaos.
Right.
And what the BBC didn't want to admit to, essentially because of their reputation, they didn't want us going after money. Mm. Do I look like a woman who goes after money? I don't, everybody. I really don't look like I go after money. It's one of my problems. I probably should do a bit more of it. We wanted to protect and defend people we knew who were put under pressure. Journalists are put under the most extraordinary pressure. And at the moment, I know we live in these interesting times. People talk about fake news. It was very, very complicated times for us to think about these things. But I know many, many people with enormous integrity who put themselves in danger. There's a brilliant story by Marie Colvin that I heard. I knew Marie slightly and she was just the most extraordinary person. And she is a journalist who ultimately was targeted and killed. And she was standing outside the Frontline Club one day, which is a club in London that a lot of media people belong to because they travel a lot so they can stay there and they can meet up there. And she was having a fag. And someone said to her, Marie, you should probably give up. And she said, we all know this is not how I'm going to go. It's just brilliant.
Wow.
Absolutely that. You know, they're incredible. And yes, there are awful people who are journalists, but...
Well, isn't it any profession?
Exactly.
I think it's interesting, like you said, it is interesting times that it's the first time, especially in my life, where the art of journalism and the integrity of journalism has suddenly become extremely important. Whereas I grew up with like, journalists are good and they do the thing, they write the paper. Why do we need to worry about it? And now it's suddenly like, whoa, that is massively important. And then massively important that they are looked after in the correct
Absolutely.
Way.
Because democracy does depend upon them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the things I say in the show, and I think I'm right. democracy is dependent upon the free flow of information.
Mm.
And someone, say, at the moment for me, and you know, hot in the news as we record, is Carol Cadwalader with her work on Cambridge Analytica, and she's recently, you know, she's been under extraordinary pressure. Without taking any sides in that conversation, I mean, I don't need to have an opinion on the matter to know that she needs to be investigating that,
whatever
she finds, and she should be free to do so.
Yeah.
But in fact, what happens is that the journalists are threatened, and we all say, well, journalists are venal. No, I don't say that, but, you know, we have this kind of response. So, yeah, and so to me, the idea that the BBC basically tried to take us down, and including during Kate's inquest, the barrister came over and said to us, well, in recess, he just went, I just want you to know, if you defame anybody, the BBC will sue you. And it was very funny because I just leant back. I was sitting next to my mum. I was between my mother, my sister's fiance and my mum, and my brother obviously was there. And there was this ridiculous big BBC team sitting at the next table. And I just leant back in my chair and went, oh, for fuck's sake, you stupid stack of fucking pricks. Fuck, if we're going to defame anybody, we'd have done it already. We're 4 years in, you blinding idiots. Go fuck yourselves. I was so angry. It's so insulting. And they threatened us. Yeah. They threatened my, you know, pensioner mother. I'm like... And my sister's fiance. It was the most unpleasant experience. And
wow.
But I refer to it as corporate clench. You'll see it. The NHS will do it. I love the NHS. Building companies will do it. Organisations do it. Directly something happens, if they can't bring you in, they will eject you. They brought in Peter Gresto, who's a journalist Kate was with on the day. They brought Peter into the fold and they thought they could bring us in. And when we said, but we've got some questions, they rejected us and then went hell for leather to make us look like lunatics. I am a lunatic, but not in that way.
Yeah, yeah. That's beside the point. So where were you when you found out that Kate had died?
I heard she'd been shot while I was working in a hotel. I used to host these educational conferences because I'm an actor. So I was hosting these educational...
I have hosted one of those educational conferences myself,
There you go.
Myself,
maybe we should do another series of podcasts.
Yeah, yeah.
Other jobs. I was in this hotel looking after these teachers, and I got a phone call from my mother, who was in Johannesburg where Kate lived, staying with Kate, and then Kate had to go off to Somalia. So mum was pretty hacked off because she was on holiday on her own in Johannesburg. And she said, Kate's been shot. And I got on with stuff at this point, phoning people. I phoned my brother. Phoned my sister's best friend, who's happened to be based in Cape Town. He grew up with us, but he lived there. I phoned my sister's best friend at the BBC. Mm. I just started phoning people who I thought should know, family and all of this. And then they suggested maybe that my company I work for, we weren't both at the hotel, said, you can go if you like. And I was like, oh yeah, I suppose I could go. Yeah. So I was just like in manic work mode. Yeah. The news we were getting was that she was injured, but her life wasn't in danger.
Right.
So I didn't think she was going to die. And although I'm acquainted with bizarre and extraordinary events already, I was told that. And I felt felt exhilarating. And then I was thinking, okay, so if she ends up with a disability of some kind, maybe she has to use a wheelchair, that's fine. We can live together in London. We can do this. We can do that. What if she gets HIV, if she has a transfusion? That's dealable with these days. That's a far... better diagnosis than it was 20 years ago. Well, that's okay. That would be livable with. These were the thoughts that were going through my head because I'm a very positive person. And I then got a cab to my old company. I used to be an agent. I was an agent before I became an actor. And met my brother there. And then my old boss was giving me a lift down the Charing Cross Road because I was in a play at the time. So he was giving me a lift down to this theatre in Kennington. My brother had gone to take some library books back. Because we were preparing for having to leave the country, we thought we were going to have to go to. She was going to have to go. She was still in Mogadishu, but she was going to be transferred to Johannesburg or to Nairobi. So we were thinking we were going to either fly to Nairobi or fly to Johannesburg. And I was on the phone to my mother driving down. Nick was driving me down the Charing Cross Road, and she just made this horrendous noise, and I knew Kate was dead.
How did she find out? So she was on the phone to you.
She was on the phone to me, and she was in my sister's bedroom, my sister's house. So one of my mother's sisters married a South African, so we had family there. By this stage, this aunt of mine, my mum's best friend, was dead, but her, obviously the family were there with her, my uncle, and he just walked into the room and she could see from his face.
Wow.
Because the BBC had turned up. My sister's colleagues, poor sister's colleagues, had turned up, obviously to deliver the news in person. And it just, having my mother on the other side of the world was just horrendous.
Yeah,
we weren't there. At least she did have my uncle. She had my cousins who were great and were close to them. I screamed at Nick. He stopped. I had to stop in central London. It's a very busy place in rush hour. And I got out of the car. It was February, so it was dark. It was about probably 5 or 6-ish, I should think. And I ran back up the road to the library. And I stood in the doorway and I could see my brother at the counter doing whatever. And I did. You know, your mind's working very quickly. And I was like, how do I tell Charles Kate is dead? And as we've discussed, I'm a show-off. So I stood in the doorway, a number of metres away from the desk, threw my arms in the air and just yelled at him, she's dead. So everyone looked at me like I was odd. And he came over and we stood under the book detector thing and embraced one another. And we got in the car and we went down to the theatre. And I wanted to carry on. I was like, I'm going to do the show, doesn't matter. Kate can't die again. I haven't got to go to Nairobi. I can't fly to South. By this stage, we couldn't fly. So it was too late to get on flights to South Africa, overnight flights to South Africa, which is the fastest and most convenient way of getting to Johannesburg. And it was too late by this point to get on flights from Gatwick or Heathrow. So we had a night in London then, and we got in the car, and Nick drove us to the theatre, and I was persuaded not to do the play.
What was your thought then? Did you just kind of go into automatic of like, yeah, I can do the play?
Well, I was like, yeah, I'll just do it. What's it matter? It was sort of like, what on earth does it matter? It's partly shock. You know, there's masses of adrenaline go through your system.
Oh, God, yeah.
All of that. And I also... And this has sort of stayed with me, unfortunately. It's not a very good way to live your life. I'm like, who cares?
Mm.
What does it matter what I do? I could eat a sandwich or throw myself off a bus or never get up again. They're all equal. Don't make any odds.
Yeah.
And I have to go, no, you have got to eat something.
Yeah, that we've talked about that before on the show, that sort of weird, that weird mental attitude that happens after big grief where you're like, I don't really think anything matters anymore.
Yeah.
And it is hard to shift that. And it is sort of a depression, but not a depression in a way, because it's similar to depression of like, oh, what's the point? But it's like I always feel like you have such screaming evidence of like, yeah, what's the point? People die.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you have to kind of convince that person in your head and be like, there's still a point to getting up and having a shower and, you know, smiling and talking.
Totally.
There is, but there is that definite sort of, I don't know, I feel like it's sort of like chiselled onto a piece of stone in your head, isn't it? Like, everyone gonna die.
No, totally. Well, and that doesn't, and I suppose in a way it's interesting you say it like that, because that, because of my life experience, I don't really remember before knowing that death was absolutely sitting right. And I often say my death is sitting right next to me now, and it's the only thing I get up for sometimes. It's the knowledge that my death's going to be there. Morning, how you doing? Nice hat. You really could try wearing something other than, you're a goth, never mind. And it's my one company. It's the thing that makes life living, is the fact that I'll die. Yeah. It's the only way I can get through a day is my knowledge of my own death, which I realise is odd. Because people go, what?
I don't think it's odd. I just think it's different, because I think you've had death so close from a very early age, for starters, and then twice, which, you know, is a lot, it's careless, as Oscar Wilde would say. But I think if you haven't had that, it's easy to, because what you know is the truth. Death is there. It is the point of living. We are going to die. So that's why you have to get up and put on your happy face and jump around and dance when the music's playing, because you're going to die. But I think if you haven't had it pressed up against your face like that, it's very easy to disassociate yourself from it, make it clean, to make it far away, and it's not, oh, that won't happen to me, and I'm safe. But yeah, I think
you're right, and I think maybe it's even more than that. I don't know, I can't remember how many years now. Forgive me, my dear friend James. A number of years ago now, probably more than five, a school friend of mine, I've known since I was eight, called me on a Friday night, like 11 o'clock at night. He's like, are you still out? I've got to pass out. I'm out. I've been with clients. Are you around? So we met. I've been doing shows. We met up. He'd been drinking. I'd had a beer or two, but he'd been drinking. And he got a black cab to where I live in Brixton and to go and have some more drinks. He was like, let's have more drinks. I want to see you. I never see you. We got out the cab. He's a barrister. He's very successful. So he paid for the cab. It was great. And we got out of the cab and he put down his bags and he said, Becca, I owe you an apology. And I was like, oh, wow, we're going to be here all night, mate.
Yeah.
I was like, what on earth? Yeah, which of these things are you going to apologise for? And he goes, and his father had recently died, and I knew his father, and he said, I had no idea. At school, I should have known. Mm. I had no idea. And it was a wonderful apology. It was a moment I've been waiting for all my life, as horribly, I think of it as people passing into the room that I've spent my whole life in.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting there knitting, and they turn up. Yeah. They're in a state of, like, complete confusion. Their clothes are a mess. They've got lipstick on their forehead. They're holding a bottle of brandy. And they're like, so-and-so's dead. And I'm like, mm-hmm. Yeah. Come and sit down. Let's get
wankered.
Well,
that's what we call the club. Like,
totally.
You're in the club. You just got here really... I feel like we just got here early.
Yeah, no, totally. But the thing about it for me is people... I haven't passed through it. Whatever happened to me snapped me... Like, my father's death snapped me backwards and my sister's death snapped me the other way.
Right.
I am off the scale. I see people pass through. They go through terrible grief and they reconstruct themselves. And I just sit there knitting like somebody out of a Greek.
Do you think out of they a Greek. Do?
Well, yes, because people start having fond memories, Carrie. Do you have fond memories of your father?
Mixed.
But you do have some fond memories.
I have to dig, definitely. But not because...
Through the difficult ones.
Well, I think it's painful. I think that's what I've done somehow.
Yeah.
It's painful to remember fond things. So
that's interesting.
It's sort of like I have to... And then that makes me think, oh, we have a terrible relationship. Like it was difficult. It was a very cantankerous and tempestuous relationship.
Yeah.
But there were definitely fun things. And since therapy, I've had to be like, oh, yeah, that was nice, wasn't it? But I think I'm afraid to look at them. I think that's what
I've
done.
Do you know what you think they might do to you?
I think it's painful. I think it's just upset because it's like if I... Oh, now you're going there, Becca. How did you do this?
I'm really good at this.
Yeah. I think if I think too much and... I think for a long time I held on to we didn't get on very well and it was difficult. And, you know, that's sort of why, like, I'm fine because we didn't even...
It's kind of okay he's dead.
It's kind
of
okay, yeah, because, like, it was so complicated. But if I see the other, sort of the softer side of him, I think I get, like, oh... Like, a bit like you said about you and your sister, like, oh, I might have been really good friends with him by now because we might have got somewhere else because we were quite similar and... There were lots of things I know he would have got about me that, like, other people don't get. And so, yeah, I think I sort of go, not that room, thanks very much.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a little bit too much. I think it's interesting you say that, like, people have passed through because having done this show and talked to so many people, I just feel like...
Oh, you're changed forever. You go out a different... You don't go out the door you came in.
No, yeah.
You go out a different door. It's not Mr. Ben.
Yeah.
You go out a different door.
Yeah. I know what you mean. Of like, I feel like I'm still in the room a little bit.
There's a proper kind of... There are these theories of grieving.
Oh, yeah, which, the, well, yeah, I get annoyed. The stages one is absolutely bullshit. Stage. Yeah.
Well, no, that goes anger, denial, anger, 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 denial, bargaining, anger, denial, yeah. bargaining, anger, denial, yeah, bargaining, denial. Anger, denial.
Silence. I just 5 years later, it. Anger, as angry as ever before.
Out like, of nowhere, over a yeah. fork. No, totally. Yeah. So there's that. And there's also, there are these things like, you'll start having fond memories. Mm. And some form of peace is achieved. And I, you know,
yeah, I do feel like that. Actually, I do feel like, well, but then I think every time I think I've got a peace, then 2 years later, I think, oh, I didn't have a peace. Like, do you know what I mean? It's
so you had,
evolving.
I suppose movement maybe then is the thing then, that it is
yeah,
changing.
Yeah.
I think the ossification, I suspect something's ossified inside me and there ain't no shaking it off. I think yeah. it is the movement that is potentially the thing that is the only indicator, as with everything else, with heart, you know, any loss, heartbreak, all yeah. the same things, you're like, oh wow, it does still upset me to think about that person, but actually I haven't thought about them for 3 weeks.
Yes.
This ex,
yeah,
you know, I that's a great sign. And I think we all I presume other people experience that, we go, oh god, I feel awful again and I'm going to go for a gin, but that is 3 whole weeks where I haven't gone for a gin because of that person.
Yeah.
And it is that progress which only reveals itself like a long walk when you look back.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I wonder, this is interesting because you lost someone young, that I thought I was moving. I would have sworn, if you spoke to me 5 years ago, I would have gone, I've moved through it. And I honestly think, like, the last year, I've really actually started to let go of a lot of stuff. And my big thing, which I talked about before, is, like, I was so afraid to stop being 15 because that's the person he knew.
Yeah.
And I think if you lose someone young, it's quite tricky to, like, people, like, move forward, and you're like, but I only know them as a 6-year-old or, you know, 20-year-old. So, like, if I lose that, like, if I found it's, like... I remember when getting married, I found that so hard because I was like, 15-year-old me wouldn't be getting married, having a baby. 15-year-old me. So there was the 15-year-old me inside being like, stay here because here is where your dad is still alive.
Yes, totally.
And here is not even alive, pre-trauma. This is where everything was sort of all right. Do you remember that? Stay there. And having to let go of that person, I found like, and my therapist calls this like, just, you know, those other losses are as painful.
Totally. And that, well, the echoes.
Yeah, the echoes.
Anything that touches, people call it, I'm writing a blog this year because of it being the 40th anniversary of my father's death. And I'm like, what else can I do to try and make myself less barking? So I'm writing this blog, and one of the blogs I haven't published yet is called Trigger Happy, because it wasn't until literally last year sometime. I was like, oh, all these things trigger me. It's, oh my God, I am so with it. I'm so now, guys. And I have been for, I don't know, 30 years after my father's death, the sight of a grown man with a 6-year-old daughter or more in that part leveled me. And you're sitting in a pub, you're sitting on a bus, you're listening to somebody's tedious story about their cancer diagnosis, and I see some guy with some kid, and I'm like, Yeah, chemotherapy sounds awful. And I'm just staring at, and I am broken by that. And that's just one thing. Mm. And it is an endless cavalcade. I just feel like there's a brilliant Fry and Laurie sketch where it's a perfume symphony, basically. It's odours. So Stephen Fry is, I think it's that way around, is shoving the bottles in Hugh Laurie's face. And he basically falls over at the end. He's had so many smells. And that's what I feel like. I'm like, so many experiences send me. And I didn't speak about it very much. It was happening. It happens all the time. It's happened with, you know, about 18,000 of my friends have got married, and every one of these 18,000 weddings, I sit there and look at their father in them. It was never going to happen to me.
Yeah.
It was never going to happen to me. And sure enough, it hasn't, and it never will. And it's endless. Mm. And there's nobody else needs to know this. I'm telling you now because here we are.
I know that feeling. I really do.
That to me feels like insanity.
Yeah.
You know, that to me feels like a form of insanity.
And that's the thing, I think what I've found lately. Talking about, I mean, I know everyone says it, but fucking hell, it's right. Talking about it and realizing I'm not the only person who feels like that.
Yes.
Because I didn't talk about it for years and years and years. To the point my mum said to me the other day, you weren't very sad after he died. And I was like, everyone thought I was fine. I was like, my God, how could you think that? I was so fine. But like, I think that's really helped me so much to go, oh, everybody feels like, because that's how you feel when someone dies. But because we don't talk about much. So yeah, the father thing, I realised literally something happened today and I was like, I'm so bad at talking to middle-aged men who have brown hair and brown eyes, because I feel like I don't know. I'm like, I get this weird, like, I don't want to talk to you because you remind me of my dad. So I sort of start acting like a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
I sort of stop listening and I'm like, yeah, yeah, thinking, oh, this is really annoying. And then I thought, hang on, Carrie, it's not annoying. He reminds you of your dad, and that's what's happening. You're sort of unable to deal with it.
Yeah.
And yeah, father, the bride speeches at weddings. Fuck off.
I can't. Is that my father and any other man in my case? You know, I've been single since 1920, basically. No man is ever going to stand up and say I'm great. Mm. They never have. They never will. But that's slightly unkind to my one long-term partner I had. He was fabulous, but he was very shy. He was never going to stand up and say anything. He obviously, you know, he loved me. He thought it was fabulous. No one's ever going to do that. Then I say to myself, that's ridiculous. What does it matter? Stop being absurd. What does it matter?
But I think what this is the problem I've worked out. It's like you dismiss it. So then you're like, it either has to be awful or fine. Yeah. Rather than, that's what my therapist is trying to work with me on, it's okay to feel that pain. And just allow yourself just to feel it. And then if you feel it a little bit, hopefully it doesn't overwhelm you. That's what I used to have. I'd be like, it's fine. Who cares? Stop being an idiot. You're pathetic. Da-da-da-da. Get on with it.
Yeah.
And now I try and go, yeah, it's hard. My dad died, so that's a bit painful.
Yeah.
And just try and stay there. But it's fucking hard because everything in my body is like, make a joke. Yeah,
leave it. Totally. Keep moving.
Yeah,
and also for me, and despite the fact that, you know, anyone who listens to this who knows me probably goes, will you make me feel uncomfortable? I have a desire not to make people feel uncomfortable. In the show that you saw, that Martin and I made together.
It's an amazing show.
Thank
amazing.
You.
Yeah.
I'm glad I mentioned the show. thank you very much. I love it. Yeah. I think it's a great show. I'm not going to lie. One of the things Martin and I decided to do was to excise the anger, essentially. There's very little anger in it. I mean, there may be a reading of anger that you feel.
I definitely felt... I could see the anger, and I could see that it had been processed. I could because that real grief anger is so unpleasant.
Oh yeah, and it feels like blame.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had some. I went to drama school at 30, and my sister was killed when I was 32. And I had a great group of friends who essentially dropped me. Not all of them, and some of them have come back afterwards and apologised.
Actors are not great with the older real emotions, are we?
Well, I think
you're not the first person to say that. On
oh
the
no,
show.
I'm telling you, it's like, fascinating. Yeah. A couple of, you know, Jenny, I had a couple of two best friends at drama school. One of them was unbelievably brilliant, together with another close friend of mine, the two of them. They're called, I'm going to name check them, they're called Rachel and Emma. And wherever our lives have gone since, I don't think I'd be here without them.
Mm.
My other closest friend, who I won't name, but he knows who he was absolutely appalling and decided, has since subsequently decided I'm a terrible person. Now I may be, but I was a terrible person before my sister died.
Yeah.
And literally, one of the things that another of our close friends said to my friend Rachel, we went to drama school together, this woman said, she said to me, you've got to stop blaming us for your sister's death. And I was like, I'm not. As a guy with a gun, it's all very clear. That's all very documented. But she felt it because what she couldn't tolerate was my generalised anger.
Yeah.
And the other thing that the other best mate from drama school said, he said to our mutual friend, we just want the old Bex back. And poor old Rachel went, she just went, she said, who do you think would most like the old Bex back? This unbelievable, they met my sister. They couldn't tolerate it. Now, I get that. And I'm sure I have not been there for friends of mine who've been traumatised.
Yeah.
There is absolutely no doubt that
I have let people down, left, right and centre,
though I've known what I know.
Mm.
And most of that time, I will have done it unconsciously, actually, because I'm so aware of this. But I'm sure I've been terrible.
Mm.
But if someone came to me and said, you've been terrible, I'd listen. That's my thing. I will listen
yes,
if you want
definitely.
To tell me. Because you have an experience that is yours that I don't understand. And I can't, you know, you and I obviously have got loads of things that are chiming here about having dead dads. Mine's got 1970s sideburns because it was 1978. So, you know, luckily you don't see men like that around.
Oh, phew.
Exactly. Really? But still, there is a gap between you and me.
Mm.
Of comprehension and understanding, however many points we touch on.
Yeah, of course, of
there
course.
There is that these gaps are enormous, so you can never experience what's up. But all you can do is ask the question.
Yeah.
This is what's so lovely about doing a podcast about what you're doing. It's about asking questions. And then you tell me how you feel. And I go, okay, I'm not going to say, no, but didn't you experience it like this? Because I did.
Yeah.
Or I imagine it would be like that. So isn't that how it's for you? You know, I think with cancer, it's fascinating. With the diagnosis of cancer, you never know how somebody feels.
No, and it's especially doing the show, there's so many, like you said, these points, these crossover points, and then so many not.
Yeah.
There's so many, because everybody's relationship to that person is different.
Uh-huh.
So your relationship to your relationship to your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your dog, you know, your grandparents, that's,
yeah.
I can never experience
totally.
And understand that. But yeah, to say, that's incredible, isn't it?
Like, isn't it amazing? And it was,
but what it means is, what he's saying, is I don't want this pain. Yes. I don't want to know this pain exists.
Exactly.
That's actually what that sentence is. Yes. I want the old Bex back who didn't have pain. I don't want to know that that pain
exactly.
is out there.
And I saw my response sort of wanted to be, do you know, I'm really, I mean, I don't know how funny I've been on this podcast, but I am, I'm a really funny person, right? And I'm like, I'm a really funny person. Do you know why I'm so funny? It's because my father died when I was six and I have been tap dancing ever since to make you feel okay about my loss. Mm. That's what I learned when I was tiny.
And then to have someone say, and it's still not good enough.
Yeah.
That's what I'd hear. I'd be like, oh, and it still, oh, my pain was so, too obvious for you.
Exactly. It's absolutely astonishing. So I'm like, now my sister's died. And another friend, you know, good egg, it's another conversation. She approached me to apologise because they finally realised they'd essentially ostracised me in this period of time after Katie died. It does happen.
Yeah.
And she said there'd been this event and she'd been annoyed because I hadn't greeted her when I had arrived. That's why all this thing had kicked off. It's all very odd. And she said, I'm so sorry. She said, the thing is, this event had happened, like, it was Kate died in February, the event was in October. She said, I thought you'd be over it by then. She literally said that to me. I thought you'd be over it by then. So I said,
my God.
I know.
And these are actors. Do you understand what emotion is?
Yeah, but what they, and they're not talking about this specific person, but in general, what actors often enjoy doing is, I refer to it as having a wank.
Yeah.
They want to be having their emotion, like, oh, I want to try out having an emotion of feeling really distressed at somebody's alcohol problem. What they don't want to live is every day with somebody they love who's killing themselves with alcohol. Because that isn't fun.
No, that's
right?
Not fun.
What's fun is some half hour where you explore your feelings and then you go to the pub and talk about your bloody bathroom decorating. That for me, and I sound really intolerant, is because I am. But I'm like, so she didn't. She said to me, she goes, I thought you'd be over it by then. And I said, you know, you got a sister. She said, yes. I said, imagine she died. And then the first Christmas came or the first birthday came, those events. And I watched her before my very eyes. Her face just transformed. And she clearly hadn't, in all the time that she'd been thinking about my situation, which I hope was a lot of the time because I'm very important, it had never crossed her mind to think, if my sister died, how would I feel? And in that moment, she went, I'm so sorry. And I thought, I haven't asked you a complicated question. Yeah. I haven't asked you to do an extraordinary thing. All I've said is, think about if you were in my shoes, just briefly, seeing as you have a sister. And she got upset and cried and was apologising. And
I'd be so sad. Oh, right, yeah, now you realise it.
And I kind of, and I suppose partly I feel my purpose, there is no purpose to life as far as I'm concerned. There's no meaning, there's no afterlife, there's no God. But as I go along, like, that sounds really bleak.
No,
I don't think
it does. It's liberating in many ways, yeah.
But it's about helping each other, and that includes, you know, I'm genuinely willing to learn things if there's anything you can teach me.
But I think I'm always looking for similarities, but we both have that thing of like, okay, this really awful shit thing happened. If I can help some way, if somehow my story makes you go to your friend who I don't know and be nicer to them because you spoke to me about grief, thank the fucking Lord, who I'm not sure
that
is there.
Who definitely isn't in, he's there. No, when I said making the show with Martin, the making the show was an extraordinarily difficult and marvellous process. I was lucky to meet a wonderful collaborator who I adore. And I wouldn't have been able to make it without him. And it was hard making the show, but I loved it. And I learnt that I could write and all these things, and it proved me as a performer. He said, what is it you want out of it? I said, I want one person to come to the show, and one of two things: they either feel slightly less alienated and alone or weird or messed up or whatever, because they go, oh, somebody else feels like that, or somebody else is even weirder than I am, that's my main hope. Or they say to themselves, I'm going to call Colin because I haven't known what to say to him since his mother died, but now I'm just going to call him and say, I don't know what to say to you. Anyway, so the first night we're in Switzerland, because that's where Martin was based. Of course, I premiered a 1 hour and 40 minutes solo show in English in Switzerland. It was terrifying. And this woman came up to me, the first person I spoke to after the show. She said that she'd been standing in a queue 30 years ago with her date, and a guy had come up and stabbed her companion in the back, and he had bled to death on the pavement.
Oh, my God.
And she said, for 30 years, she thought she was crazy for everything she'd done afterwards, but now she'd seen our show, she realised she wasn't, it was just what people do. And that's the second time I've welled up in this whole conversation. The first time was talking about dads and daughters, but that for me was one of the single most moving moments in my life, because my life makes no sense to me, and my life is pointless. and to give somebody I'd never met, a woman in, I don't know, I guess Leslie was in her 50s, she went on to book the show fabulously, She went on to book the show and we got to know her well. So I heard more about the story. But for 30 years, she'd been alone in that.
Yeah.
And the show, we have always, there's been a handful of times that we haven't gone for a drink afterwards with the audience or talked to people after. I mean, people come and talk to me, people who know me, but people who don't know me. And we talk. And all I do is say, I'm so sorry, you sound normal. This is my own. I would have a T-shirt that says, I'm so sorry, you sound normal. Because there isn't anything abnormal. There is no abnormal reaction. And I say that because I feel really abnormal in my reaction to my father's death and my inability to function. But there isn't an abnormal reaction. Therapists in theory will tell you about processes of grieving and blah, 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 blah. It is beyond our understanding.
Mm, yeah.
And you go on the journey that you go on and you will find that you will or you will not have people who support you and help you. And if you are lucky to have those people, I think, this is my experience, it will be easier, but it won't be okay. And if you don't have people around you, it'll be that much harder. And so to have made something where people, and I mean, I've got stories coming out of my ears, the things people have told me.
Yeah, same. Oh, same, like since doing amazing, this show, the emails, the incredible emails. And that's the reason I keep doing this show when it's hard and I think you must have this. I don't want to talk about it anymore. Yeah. I'm sad today. And you read an email and someone goes, I thought I was crazy. I didn't know that it was grief.
And it can go on.
And you just think, fuck, like it's just, we're all just trying to figure out what to do when someone isn't here anymore.
And because people don't talk about it and because it isn't a suitable dinner party conversation, it is for me, but it isn't for other people. People can feel, I mean, this is what I said earlier on about gaslighting children. We gaslight children by implying they should be fine.
Yeah.
So I don't, people will often maintain their demeanour for their kids as if they're well. So the kid gets confused because they're like, well, I should be fine. Mm. Mum's fine. Why am I unhappy? The kid gets confused and we are doing it in a way to each other all the time culturally.
Yeah.
And I'm aware that I do, because I get up on stage and people will say to me, it's great that you know you're kind of over your sister's murder. And I'm like, okay, I don't know where to start with that. I'm performing. I'm doing a crafted show. If you're going to see me grieving, that's me sitting on the stairs drinking gin. That's a different thing entirely. I'm doing a show. I'm presenting a thing. I would never want people to think, but inevitably they do, which is partly why I'm blogging.
Yeah.
And I'm meant to be writing a book. Is that?
Yeah, as if
to
it can be
the chaos. Yeah. It isn't okay. All you do is have. It's a bit like seeing, you know, images of people on the catwalk or at functions in magazines. Yes, they do look great. They look amazing. They've probably been photoshopped. Even if they haven't, their makeup's good, their clothes fit, all of that. That's not how they function most of the time. They don't look like that.
Yeah.
When they're trying to get something done from the high shelf in the bathroom, that's not how they dress. And it's the same thing. So the. And while I think people should be allowed not to talk about their trauma and not to talk about their issues, and I think that's entirely acceptable because I will talk about mine, don't worry, I'll fill in the space. People should be allowed to, and there is no inappropriate place, with the possible exception of you coming up to me at my mother's funeral and saying, you know, my dad died when I was 15, I'm so upset.
Yeah.
Apart from that, there isn't an inappropriate place.
Oh. And on that note, Rebecca, thank you so much for coming to talk to me about Les and Kate.
Thank you for having me on.
You can follow Rebecca on Twitter at Rebecca Paynton, and she will let you know if she's doing her incredible show again, plus her other new work, so do follow her there. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast, and you can email us thegriefcast@gmail.com. Music was provided by the Glue Ensemble, and the show was edited by Kate Holland, with thanks to Whistledown Studios. And remember, you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.